Now, a coffee mug, a worn-in T-shirt, a painting on the wall, all objects in our lives, no matter how ordinary or unusual, have the potential to have personal value, according to our next guest. There could be a lot of different reasons why something might have meaning. Maybe someone made it for you, or someone special gave it to you. You got it at a time in your life that was significant. It was the most money you ever spent on something. It was owned by someone special before you. It has a story. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Whether it's something you use every day or something you never touch, what object is important in your life? If there was a museum of you, what would be the main item on display? Does it have a story? Is there a family heirloom or hand-me-down that you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We asked around here at Wisconsin Public Media and got some great stories. Larry Mueller says, I have many fishing tackle boxes, but I never use the oldest one. It's filled with the oldest overworked lures I own. The box and lures are past their prime, but not the memories they hold. The lure I used to catch my first 40-inch muskie, the time I accidentally knocked the tackle box in the water while trying to catch a big muskie, the lure of a magazine photo of me with a large muskie caught in the fall. All muskies for Larry. It's the oldest box of lures I own, but wouldn't part with it for any money. Christine Harold is a professor of communication at the University of Washington. Her most recent book is called Things Worth Keeping, The Value of Attachment in a Disposable World. Christine, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I know from our last conversation, you think a lot about our connections with things. Are there items in your life, Christine, that you consider, I don't know, like an heirloom, a personal treasure of some sort?
Absolutely. So I write a little bit about mine in my book, and it's I call him Pooh Bear, and it's an old Winnie the Pooh that I was given maybe about 49 years ago by a friend of my mom's when I was a toddler, and he's very well worn, barely hanging in there, but I slept with him for many, many years, and now he has a prized place on top of a shelf in my closet.
I guess mine would be my saxophone, my tenor saxophone. I got it when it was clear that I was going to keep playing after high school. And I got it from a guy who had played it in the Mercer Ellington Orchestra, the Stan Kenton Orchestra. It was like it's 100 years old or so now. It's not the most valuable thing in the world, and it's pretty beat up looking. But yeah, it's got a history. It's got a big connection with my life. If there's something I'd be bummed to lose, that would probably be it. I don't know. There's so many different reasons, Christine, that somebody might feel a connection to things big or small. Can you talk about a few of the things that make an item the one we want to keep?
Yeah, you know, I'm happy to talk about that. And it's not just one thing. You know, I think that the first thing we think of is oftentimes those sentimental objects, like your saxophone and Pooh Bear for me, and, you know, those sorts of things that maybe they were handed down from a loved one, or maybe, you know, like I also, I have this pair of Levi's, 501 Levi's that I've had for many, many years. I haven't worn them in a long time. We won't go into why, but you know, they traveled with me to Europe. I wore them in college, and, you know, they have stains and tears that kind of tell a story of their own, you know, so there's those objects that we kind of imprint our stories on, but then there's lots of other reasons that aren't quite as romantic. So for example, a lot of times we keep things because they have some kind of group affiliation, right? People might think, well, I'm a Nike kind of person, right? And in fact, product designers will talk about product variants, like a particular kind of Nike, like Air Jordan or something, and then product specimens, your particular pair of Air Jordans that have the wear and tear of use in your life. They take on patterns of use. And so brands, you know, try very hard to get us to imprint on a particular variant of an object, but it takes on more meaning as we live with it, use it, and so on. Other times, things just, you know, we see them as self-expression. Like, I'm a person who likes Chuck Taylors, or I'm a person who likes Vans, right? That you kind of identify with things in that way. Other things are just pleasurable to use. They have a nice interface, or they might not have an efficient interface, but there's something about using them or wearing them that give us pleasure in some way. So there's lots of ways that objects can come to mean, but studies do show that memory is probably the strongest, that makes some things indispensable and others that we can more readily discard.
We're talking to Christine Harold from the University of Washington, author of the book Things Worth Keeping, The Value of Attachment in a Disposable World. We're talking about the things we keep as keepsakes, things we have a special connection with, objects that tell a story about themselves and maybe about us or a loved one. You could join in with yours at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Wendy is with us in Algoma. Wendy, hi.
Hello.
Hi. What did you want to tell us about, Wendy?
Well, I lost my daughter in 1995, and I collect angels, and I have goosebumps just talking about it. So I have a showcase of angels, and it's very special to me, and also rainbows, because the day I lost her, a rainbow was outside.
Oh. Wendy, I'm sorry for your loss, and I'm glad you shared that. Can I ask, Wendy, were you able to ever visit the Angel Museum in Beloit? They closed, I think, a couple few years ago.
I'm sorry I lost you there.
The Angel Museum in Beloit, did you ever go there?
No.
Oh, well, they've closed. I'm sorry. But Wendy, thank you so much for sharing that story.
Beautiful.
And again, sorry for the loss of your daughter. But I imagine, Christine, that's a common story, something we connect to a lost loved one, as Wendy's angels do.
Absolutely. So we would talk about those kinds of items. Certainly, maybe there's a memory attached to them. For Wendy, but it's also that they become a symbol, right? That they become significant in that they signify, right? They represent something for her and her daughter and her hope that her daughter is with angels, is an angel, right? And that they become kind of signs that stand in for something that in this case, tragically absent. And so that's a really powerful powerful kind of significant object, in addition to the fact that when we start a collection, then in the aggregate, those objects become all the more valuable as a collection rather than kind of on their own. So that's kind of doubly powerful what Wendy's talking about.
Thanks again for calling in, Wendy. Let's go to Amber with us now in Green Bay. Amber, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What item did you want to share with us, Amber?
So I wanted to share the story of my great-grandmother's teacup. It's a teacup and saucer set from my great-grandma who immigrated in 1906. I just moved into a 60-foot square space trailer, and it was one of the items I couldn't bring myself to let go, even though I don't have a functional use for it.
Wow. So do you keep it kind of on display, Amber, where you could see it all the time? Or do you just keep it kind of tucked away, but you know you have it?
I keep it on the counter and it holds my chapsticks, but I just couldn't let go of it.
I gotcha, Amber. Thank you so much. So this item, yeah, part of her family history, but also, you know, something as fragile as a teacup survived the trip to the United States and a century past that. What do you think, Christine?
Yeah, I would be interested. I would be interested to hear kind of what the meaning that it holds for Amber. But it's interesting, you know, that there are some things like chinaware, for example, that gets oftentimes passed down generation to generation. And sometimes, as is all, I'm ashamed to say, a great grandmother's china is in a cardboard box on a shelf, mm-hmm, in my home. I would never get rid of it, but it's not something that I have on display. Whereas other items that we inherit or that just remind us of somebody, you know, one of our ancestors, that those are very, that they take on a meaning. Maybe they represent exactly what you just said about the coming to the United States and that this grandmother obviously also valued it enough to wrap it and put it in her luggage and carry it with her. So it clearly held meaning for her as well. And it's interesting how an individual object, its own meaning, it has a story that's independent of any one of us. So it might have meant one thing to the grandmother, mm-hmm, and now means something else to her granddaughter, to Amber. And so that's just an interesting ways in which objects really have a history that's in some ways independent of us. Like we cross paths with them, but we're just their steward for a period of time. And then they go on to the next person, ideally.
We're talking to Christine Harold, author of the book, Things Worth Keeping, The Value of Attachment in a Disposable World. We're talking about the things, the stuff that you find value in, that you feel a connection to. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What is something that you value? What's your most prized possession? What's the story behind it? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go back to your calls now. Paul is with us in Sorona. Paul, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to share with us, Paul?
Something I'll probably hand down to my son. I've been a carpenter all my life, and back in 1976, my wife-to-be bought me a hammer when we graduated vocational school, and I'm using the same one to this day. So I think just the fact I never lost it has some value to myself and my son. So, but yeah, those small little things mean a lot to people. It's a great program too, by the way. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks for calling in. I want to ask, like, what does it mean to you when you pull out that hammer that has survived, what is it now, 4.5 decades in your hands? What does it mean to you to pull that out and work with it?
Well, I'm not really sure because I can lose my glasses any given moment in my life, but somehow it does have some meaning to it, and somehow it survived with as many tools as one uses in a lifetime, and I don't know. I just take the pride. I've kept something all these years. I mean, it's probably the fourth on my list, besides my wife and my kids, but pretty important, yes.
I love it. Paul, thank you so much. Glad the wife and kids are still ahead of the hammer, though. Christine, yeah, I don't know. Longevity, it's practical. It's the connection with his wife. So much going on there.
Absolutely. I mean, his wife gave it to him, which is valuable. It's useful, right? So it has a utilitarian function, but it's more than that for him. I think for Paul, it's the ultimate durable good, a hammer. It's not going anywhere. And there's really we're not going to, see a hammer 2.0 necessarily. It does its job. It's not going to be, outdated in that sense. There's just something very simple about that tool that I think is really, I think a really interesting example in all kinds of ways. It's like you just can't really improve on the design of a good hammer.
Paul, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Let's go next to Anne in Janesville. Anne, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about Anne?
So when my husband and I were dating, he would use the straw wrappers from our, like, drink straws to make little people. He actually learned to make straw men from his dad, and I have kept every little straw man that he made throughout the whole time we were dating. We've been married almost 22 years now, and now and again he'll make me little straw men. And so I have all from when we were dating, all the ones from our marriage so far. And he taught my kids how to make them, and my daughter and son have both made me a few. So I had it's like a small purse with little straw men with various dates on them, and those are just priceless mementos.
I love it. Anne, I got to ask, though, those straw wrappers are pretty fragile. How have you kept those intact all these years?
Actually, several of them, we had a laminating machine at one point when the kids were much smaller. I stuck them on a laminating thing. But you can also get like the self-laminating sheets. Those work too. But they're not really handled very often because they are, you're right, they can start coming unwound. But they're super cute.
I love it. Thank you, Anne, so much for sharing that. So some romance in that one, Christine.
Yeah, definitely romance. And what's also very cool about Anne's example is that there is actually a lot of artists and eco designers, people who are thinking about what can we do with just all of those little things that would otherwise end up just being trash. And there's so many artists either with an kind of ecological frame or just people who are interested in kind of taking those mass produced everyday items that are just, a straw wrapper on its own is just the most utterly mundane object. And yet through the application of a little artistic skill and talent, her husband transformed it into these keepsakes. And so I think that's a really powerful and interesting example of something that artists are exploring all the time these days, with like, how can we take those things that are sort of otherwise discarded and turn them into something meaningful?
Thank you so much for sharing that at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Christine Harold from the University of Washington, author of the book Things Worth Keeping, talking about the things in your life that you have found to be worth keeping, that keepsake from a family member maybe, or something that has a lot of meaning in your own personal life. You could join in with yours at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Richard in Wauwatosa. Richard, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I have an interesting one. I come from a family of avid cribbage players, and I happen to be the lucky owner or steward of both of my grandfather's cribbage boards, one of which was handmade by him. So I feel very fortunate, and my wife and I use those cribbage boards almost daily.
And Richard, I think a lot of people might face the decision. You know, we've got this thing, we cherish it. Do we put it up on display, or do we actually play the game on it? You went with playing the game on it, and I would too. What made you say, yeah, this isn't a museum piece, we're going to use this thing?
Well, I tell you what, they are meant to be used. You know, they're made out of wood. I've had to make new pegs for them over the years, but they're kind of a thing that I don't feel would ever wear out. So we may as well use them and enjoy them.
Richard, thanks for sharing that. And Christine, I know cribbage boards here can be like objects of folk art, definitely. Mm-hmm. And Richard, and I love that he said he's the steward of them, not the owner of them.
Exactly. And that's actually an argument that I make in the book, is to encourage this sense of stewardship for the durable objects in our lives. And the thing that's great about this example of the cribbage board is that, A, it's handmade. And I think for a lot of people, you know, there was a couple of major design movements in the 20th century that both were responding to the new factory model of production. And some went hardcore toward the factory and said, yes, we're going to democratize objects for everyday people. But others went the other direction and really prioritized the handmade. And the, even those things that showed little imperfections as part of their beauty, because it showed they were like documents of the labor process, right? The document of, you know, however many days his grandfather, Richard's grandfather, spent crafting this thing, let alone Richard going on to, you know, then iterate on it in his own way and repair it over time and so on. So it's that, but then also wooden objects in particular take on, you know, they kind of take on little dings and, you know, the edges soften through use. And so, again, it's that kind of imprinting over time that I think really intensifies the value for people.
Time for one more caller. Trisha is with us in Sauk City. Trisha, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What item did you want to tell us about?
Well, I have my grandmother's pestle and mortar, and it's just something that I hold really dear to my heart. Her and my grandfather purchased it on a trip to New Mexico many, many years ago, and she recently passed this winter. But being a self-taught forager and apothecary, and it's something that I use regularly between my apothecary and cooking with my children, I cherish it.
Trisha, thank you so much for sharing that. Christine, just half a minute or so left. Some final thoughts to leave us with.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really struck by these examples. You know, we have a mortar and pestle, a game, cribbage, hammer, teacup. These are all really bodily. I mean, these are tools and games that engage the body, right? These aren't just kind of images on a screen. These are things that we hold in our hand, that people potentially that who we knew and loved held in their hands or even crafted with their own hands. There's something about all of these examples, I think, that's really illustrates the importance of real world, tangible, durable objects. And I think that they become even more precious in a time when so much of our lives exist virtually.
Christine, thanks so much for joining us again.
It's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
That's Christine Harreld, professor of communication at the University of Washington. She's the author of the book, Things Worth Keeping. You can keep sharing your keepsakes over on the Ideas Network Facebook page.